In 1921, Alfred Stieglitz, one of the most legendary figures in early 20th century photography, celebrated the success of his latest exhibition with burgeoning artist and his soon-to-be wife, Georgia O'Keeffe. When Stieglitz's apprentice, Paul Strand, introduced them to his fiancée, Rebecca Salisbury, it sparked a bond between the two couples that would last more than a decade and reverberate through the rest of their lives. Watching Stieglitz and O'Keeffe become the leading couple in American modern art led Salisbury to encourage new artistic possibilities for Strand and to examine her own potential as an artist. It was Salisbury, the least known of the four, who was the main thread that wove the two couples' lives together. Carolyn Burke writes about the quartet in her new book, Foursome, Alfred Stieglitz, Georgia O'Keeffe, Paul Strand, Rebecca Salisbury, published by Knopf, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Carolyn Burke to the roundtable this morning. Carolyn, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Joe, for inviting me.
Alfred Stieglitz, Georgia O'Keeffe, Paul Strand, Rebecca Salisbury. What brought you to these four individuals, this foursome?
It's quite a mouthful, isn't it?
That it is.
Title. Well, I started in reverse, so to speak. It was by being introduced to Rebecca Salisbury that I came to the idea of the foursome. Rebecca is the least well known. She came into her own artistic life later than the others and with more difficulties. It's only recently that she's had much attention in the art world. But when a friend told me about her and I began to do a little research into her life and particularly her correspondence, I thought, aha, she gives us a new way of looking at the better known three, that is Stieglitz, O'Keeffe, and Strand. And together, the four of them were a very, very remarkable group. So that gave birth to the idea of the foursome.
The book itself opens in 1921 with Stieglitz's New York City exhibit that contained his works of an unidentified nude. Give us a sense of why that was a good place for you to begin telling this tale.
Well, for several reasons. One is, to be practical, it's Rebecca Salisbury's introduction in a way, to this very glamorous and at the same time scandalous world of New York modern art. She also came face to face with the idea that a woman might be photographed in this way and that this might qualify as art, even though at the time photography was seen as a mechanical genre. It was very controversial in terms of acceptance by the art world. But for other larger reasons, I wanted to set the stage with all four characters at a moment of intense excitement about modern art in New York City, 1921, just when Stieglitz and his circle were recovering from the shock of World War I and were entering into a campaign to kind of vitalize modern art in America in a particularly homegrown way. Yes, that's why I chose to set it there, I suppose.
One of the things that is so fascinating about this book is there is much written about Stieglitz and O'Keeffe, and yet you bring us into a new aspect of their life through the intersection with the couple Paul Strand and Rebecca Salisbury. So bring us to the meeting point and a bit of a timeline, if you will, of the relationship.
Of all four?
Well, at least of the two,
yes.
Of how they cross paths.
All right, certainly. This is a book and a story of interwoven existences, which is a little hard to do in a linear fashion, but of course it's laid out in the early chapters of the book so that readers can know who these people are. Stieglitz was the oldest of the group by far. He was really of an earlier generation, and he often referred to the Strands as the children. But he was already well known before the First War, both for his photography. He was indeed, in my view, perhaps the most remarkable and original American photographer of the 20th century. He was also known for his art gallery called 291 after its address, 291 Fifth Avenue, where all the most modern art, first from Europe and then in the U.S., was shown. Well, he was in despair during the war of, for many reasons, political, cultural, and also how to find the next generation of American artists who could carry through and on his program of creating a more innovative kind of art at home in America. He first met Paul Strand when Strand came into 291 to look at photographs. Strand was then a young student of photography, and Stieglitz recognized his work right away. He saw that he was just the sort of person that he wanted to not only to show, but to enlist in his group and his kind of the visionary artistic program. Then, shortly thereafter, Stieglitz was introduced to the work of O'Keeffe. This will say roughly 1916, 17. O'Keeffe was then a completely unknown art student teaching art in North Carolina at a ladies' college or school, and he was equally impressed by her drawings in this case. So he entered into a correspondence with her, which grew to be the most amazing, gorgeous, luscious, fascinating correspondence, the first volume published, fortunately, in time for me to draw on. And he then arranged for her to have another show. Well, what happened in the meantime is that Strand and O'Keeffe met, and there was a very, very powerful affinity at work there, between the two youngsters, so to speak. And the three of them then formed a very unstable and irregular kind of trio, although there was not yet any, you know, sexual relationship among any of them, but there were strong attractions and affinities. Stieglitz sent Strand to the Southwest to persuade O'Keeffe, who was very ill, pneumonia and other things, to come back to New York so that she could have a year off from teaching to paint in a very remarkable period. Strand and O'Keeffe grew even closer, but decided, no, this would not lead to anything. And so Strand took O'Keeffe back to New York, where she recovered, and finally, what should we say, cast in her lot with Stieglitz. They became lovers and eventually married when he got a divorce. The last member of the group, Rebecca, comes along within a couple of years, when Strand is feeling stranded, so to speak. Many people said that Rebecca looked quite a bit like Georgia, and as an aspiring artist, was the right kind of lady for Paul. So he courted her, and they married. That makes up the foursome.
The name of the book is Foursome: Alfred Stieglitz, Georgia O'Keeffe, Paul Strand, and Rebecca Salisbury. The book is published by Knopf. As you mentioned, this couple does travel. You follow them throughout New York City. They're all over New York. And then to New Mexico, Taos in particular. Because it is in our listening area, I am interested in the Lake George connection. And of course, Stieglitz had a home, a family property there. It was very much a part of his life. It was very much a part of Georgia O'Keeffe's life and art. And as we learn in the book, also for Strand and Salisbury.
Yes, that's correct. I actually loved writing about the late George years, which are roughly 1920, 21 to 1930, we could say, for the four of them. In part because both the photography, Stieglitz's and some of Strand's, and George's paintings from those years are so beautiful and accomplished. I also enjoyed reading about the grand old mansions and the lifestyle at Lake George, starting in the mid-19th century or late 19th century when the Stieglitz family bought their home. And in certain ways, I think that the two women were closest. Their friendship formed at a time when they could really enjoy being with each other and out in the world of Lake George by the lake and in the forested parts without pressure on them. Later on, of course, they'd resume their friendship in the Southwest. But I liked writing those chapters because it's the beginning of their friendship and the beginning of Rebecca's artistic vocation in the company of Stieglitz, O'Keefe, and sometimes Strand.
Talk a little bit, because as you mentioned at the beginning, she is the least known of the foursome, Rebecca Salisbury, and what she really does somewhat behind the scenes sometimes, very much in the midst, and what she is able to do, and really ultimately the influence that these artists around her have on her own work.
Oh, well, she, first of all, I think, recognized and fell in love with both with Strand and with the Stieglitz group. They represented for her a much freer and more unconventional way of life. She was in her late 20s and thus considered a spinster, you know, in those days when she met Paul Strand. And when he took her to meet Stieglitz, particularly possibly at that scene that I open with at the gallery, she had a glimpse into another way of living that seemed like a liberation from her mother's very conventional, very late Victorian ideas about what was correct, what was, as my mother used to say, the done thing. Rebecca didn't want to do the done thing. And the Stieglitz Circle offered her a way into another way of, in another kind of seeing. That's one of Alfred Stieglitz's favorite terms, a more intense and philosophical even way of seeing life and art. And it also offered her a much freer kind of personal life. Not that she ever became a bohemian, far from it, but she felt, as I said, liberated from the way, the conventional ways in which she was brought up and which she chafed at. It also offered her the sense that she too might become an artist if she could find her own genre.
You seem that in the research of the book, obviously there are many sources, but it is the correspondence between the foursome that really allows you to mine for the story. At least that's what it seems. Yes.
Well, I was very fortunate in the sense that, although it was overwhelming too, that there was so much correspondence. It's voluminous. I don't know that anyone could ever read it all, but it's so rich and so juicy now that we have the letters between Stieglitz and O'Keefe, but also the letters, Rebecca's letters to Paul. His, unfortunately, are lost. It felt at times as if I were writing a novel and that these characters, through their correspondence, were providing me with the dialogue and their exchanges with each other. That is a great gift to a biographer.
What does it say about the art world at that time and ultimately the influence that this foursome had on it?
Ah, that's a big question. Two big questions. Well, let's see. If I take Stieglitz's point of view in a way, which one needs to understand the time, it was a moment particularly after World War One, and as the country began to recover from the very major political and cultural effects of participation in that war, even partial and late. Stieglitz and some of his friends were very consciously embarking on a program to invigorate American cultural and even public life. They were rather ambitious by creating a 20th century art that would not be European. There was a great disenchantment in his group with European models which before and during the war had been held up as, you know, the best, most forward-looking visions of contemporary life. Stiglitz and his group wanted to find American versions, to create art that was attuned to native rhythms and forms and subjects rather than seem to imitate European models. So that was the context of what they were doing in the 1920s. Starting in the early 30s, of course, with the Great Depression and the tremendous changes in social life in the U.S., Strand became more and more concerned that it was no longer appropriate or even ethical to create art in a personal way. It was not that he had been involved with an art for art's sake sort of perspective, but he came to see the Stiglitz view as too limited. In other words, he began to be much more interested in the idea of an art for the people, an art that would demonstrate the actual circumstances, the dire circumstances of the U.S. in the 30s. So gradually, he cast in his lot far more with various progressive and even kind of Marxist-inclined groups. First, the group theater in New York. He even went to Moscow and met some of the leading Russian filmmakers, because he, Strand, also made films. And there ensued a real break between Strand and Stiglitz over this disagreement. So to answer your question, Joe, I would say that Strand's development at that time and his break with Stiglitz has a lot to say about the situation of artists in the 30s, who were, of course, very concerned with the state of the country and who wanted to do what they could in their own way. Salisbury, briefly, was less politically concerned than Strand, and indeed they separated and then divorced in 1933, although they remained on very good friends. She found what she needed in the Southwest when she settled in Taos, New Mexico, and it was there that she finally found her own art form and created a different kind of life for herself.
The name of the book is Foursome: Alfred Stiglitz, Georgia O'Keeffe, Paul Strand, Rebecca Salisbury. It is published by Knopf. Carolyn Burke, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, Joe. It was a pleasure for me as well.
A great delight. Thank you very much. Again, Foursome: Alfred Stiglitz, Georgia O'Keeffe, Paul Strand, Rebecca Salisbury, published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.